This episode is brought to you by One House. Learn more about our comprehensive hospitality solutions at one-haus.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. We're coming to you live from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. It is Wednesday, September 21st, 2016. This is the 117th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talents in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a top hospitality consultant. I will introduce her in a moment. First, as I do on every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip off the show with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to take criticism as constructive. Good critique can be an influencer for improvement if you're open-minded. Sure, not all comments may be useful or even accurate to your mission, but perhaps some are, and you can use them to get better at what you do. As Thomas Keller remarked on Pete Wells' critical New York Times review of his restaurant Per Se, demoting it from 4 to 2 stars, sometimes a good kick in the teeth can make you better. So take the high road, as Keller did, and use criticism as a means of motivation and improvement. That's my tip today. Now I'm very happy to have my guest here in the studio. It is Kate Edwards, a 30-year veteran of the hospitality business. Kate founded Kate Edwards Consulting in 2007 and since has worked with some of the biggest names in the hospitality industry. Her client list includes New York City favorites Il Buco, Brooklyn Fare, Le Cirque and the Rainbow Room, and timeless hotels including the Essex House and the Plaza Hotel. Since 2008, Kate has been an instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education. She is now also an educator at Journey. She is a contributing writer, frequent speaker, and author of her first book, Hello, and Every Little Thing That Matters, the customer service book that will transform your business. So welcome, Kate.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming out.
My pleasure.
Nice to have you here. Thank you. some hospitality consulting with you.
Let's do it.
So I like to start out with how people got into the industry. What attracted you to restaurants, hospitality?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, when I was a kid, we didn't really go out to restaurants a whole lot, except when we were visiting my grandmother. And that was like the most fun thing to do. And when I went to college, I sort of just needed a job. So I applied for a job as a short order cook, actually, one summer, and ended up being the short order cook, for which I have no aptitude. And so I realized I didn't want to be in the kitchen. I wanted to be where the action was, which was the front of the house. So that switched up my intentions for being in the front of the house. And after that, I started working as a bus girl for a long time. And then I moved to the city and wrangled a job as a server, then a hostess. And then I just kept moving up the ranks and found out that I knew a whole lot and really liked it.
Wow, that's cool. So where did you grow up and go to school?
I grew up in Western New York State between Rochester and Buffalo, and then I went to school in Massachusetts at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst.
Okay.
And there's a small restaurant scene there,
mm-hmm.
but it was definitely a formulaic time for me of like, oh, cool, restaurants are something cool to enjoy. Yeah.
I had a lot of jobs in restaurants in my teens and through college, but I was never a short order cook.
Yeah, I did it once, and I still can't cook a burger to temperature. So,
well, that's a hard job. It's demanding. I give a lot of respect.
Yeah, it was hard, and I was like, other people need to be doing this.
Yeah. So before you launched on your own in 2007, so How did you gain more experience with restaurants? What were you doing after college?
Well, when I first moved to the city, I wrangled a job at the Odeon. And I had had enough experience, and I guess I presented well enough that they hired me as a server, and I was completely overqualified. And they kept me on for a couple months, and then they very kindly said, we've overhired, and, you know, we can't keep you on, which I understood perfectly because I was floundering. But I took that to heart, and I was like, I need to get a job that's more commensurate with my experience. And I ended up getting a job as a hostess at a restaurant at the time, which was the hottest thing in town. It was 44 at the Royalton. Jeffrey Zakarian was the chef. It was Brian McNally, one of his ventures, and I just learned a ton there. And I got bumped up to maitre d', and I started to get my first feet wet in terms of managing and running a restaurant from the front door, and realized that I was really sorely not quite ready for that job. And so after that, I realized I needed to get more experience because I had never been really a waiter at that level. I'd never been a bartender. And so after that, I started taking jobs to really get my experience up because I found managing without having the experience was incredibly hard to do. So that just led me from job to job. And I waited, I bartended, I co-checked. I mean, I did a little bit of everything at all sorts of different restaurants, and then landed in 1997, 2 weeks after it opened, at Balthazar, and spent 7 years there, moving up again from waiter to maitre d'. And I left there to open Per Se, which was another fantastic place to learn and grow. And
oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah, like, yeah. So did you know Anthony Rudolph from Journey from Per Se?
I didn't, actually. He replaced me, but after I left. And then we met there, because I went back in to visit, and I met him, and everyone was like, this is Anthony, and I'd heard so much about him. And we clicked then, but it wasn't until he left there that we actually struck up a friendship, and, you know, we sort of realized that we're, you know, siblings from different parents kind of thing. Like, he's my brother from another mother in a way, and we have a fond friendship now.
That's amazing. I'm also thinking, I didn't realize that, and that makes my tip even more appropriate.
Yeah. Well, your tip is right, because criticism sounds so cruel sometimes, sounds so harsh, but, you know, if you can really listen to it and take something mm-hmm. from it and grow a little taller, grow a little stronger, grow a little more humble, it can actually really help your business. So,
yes, and I just have so much respect for Thomas Keller. I feel. So he does always take the high road. He's so classy.
Absolutely.
And, that's great. And so you work with Keith McNally for a long time.
Yes.
What was that experience like? I mean, he's been such a successful restaurateur. I'm a fan of all of his places.
Oh, yeah.
Never worked for him. But
yeah, I mean, he has such an incredible vision, and he's so clear on what that vision and what that guest experience should be. For instance, when I was a waiter there, he was so insistent that we always bring the cheese plate to every table. And for the waiters, we always groaned and moaned because it was a marble cheese plate that weighed half a ton, and half the American guests didn't want the cheese anyway. But what he was absolutely correct about is that that's part of the experience of dining in a French restaurant, is having this cheese plate. And, you know, even just seeing it go through the dining room sends a message of authenticity and, you know, just reality. And I think that that's what so many guests, when I worked there, both as a waitress and as a maitre d', remarked on, is they felt transported when they walked in the door. And I think that's something that he does so well, is creating an environment and an experience that is transporting.
Yeah, no, that's true. And then you see the cheese, and I don't know, you eat with your eyes.
And yeah, so. Yeah. And whether it's going to your table or somebody else, there's something happening, right? There's some experience that's happening. And the same with the towers of seafood. You see that go by, and even if that's not your thing, you're like, wow, what is that?
Right.
You know, the visualization, the eating with your eyes, the, you know, having that experience visually and experientially is very, very powerful. I mean, we used to have a roast whole chicken for two, and that was one of those dishes that you sell one, the first one that sells in a night sells all the rest. Because we would take a stroll through the restaurant with that whole chicken and its presentation in the copper pot with the herbs and everything, and just the smell of it and then the experience of it and the, ooh, what's that? I mean, people were beguiled by that. And I mean, like, you know, places like the Nomad have taken the whole roast chicken to the next level. You know, that's what they're known for.
Right. No, very true.
Yeah.
So then you decided to leave working in restaurants and help restaurants as a consultant. Why? I mean, when did you, I mean, you made that leap, and how did you get your first client? Or was that like, did you have them already? They were like talking with them before you made the leap to go on your own, or?
I did not. I decided to go on my own, and I like the way you phrased it, because I wanted to help people. And I felt like I had learned so much from the high volume environment of Balthazar and the high quality environment that I was in to the very fine-tuned environment of Per Se. I felt like I had a very unique point of view on service. Plus, what I've always said about my experience is I have not only worked in good places, I've worked in some train wrecks back in the day. So I've seen what doesn't work as much as what does work, and I felt like I had something to share. And so I spent a couple of months developing my concept for my business, and then I just was like, I'm just going to talk to everybody I know. And so I did. And one of the people I reached out to was a friend of mine, Jason Lappin, and he had, in my knowledge, he had started his own consulting business. And at that point, he had, but he'd actually moved on, and he started working for a company called Elizabeth Blau. And if you know her,
from Las Vegas.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So based in Las Vegas, they had a client in New York City. They were going to oversee it, but they wanted somebody to be the man on the ground with that. And Jason was like, well, what do you, you know, I said, I'm just launching this business. What, you know, can you offer any advice? And he was like, yeah, I'll give you advice, but what are you doing? And I was like, well, I'm looking for clients. He's like, I've got a client for you. So he was like, can you help us out with Le Cirque, which was their client. Mm. And so that was a gift from God.
yeah, I'd say that's a good first client.
Yeah. Amazing first client. But of course, you know, incredibly, you know, for me, you know, wow, now I've got to prove my stuff. I'm saying I'm a consultant. I better bring the goods. So it ended up being a really great first client. I mean, not only, you know, because of their level of quality and just what they do, they're legendary. I learned so much from being there, but I also was able to test what I knew and, you know, test, you know, how I'm able to do things and get results and really show up for them, because they were my first client. So I took that to heart. It was a great opportunity.
Yeah. So how, I mean, how do you work? So when you had this as a new client, do you go in, observe, implement changes? Like, how does it work?
In that case, and this is the way that I used to work. So in that case, they had just lost a GM, and in that case, they needed somebody, right? So I came in, I acted as the general manager while I was trying to figure out what was happening there, because they were having some service challenges. But service problems can happen for so many different reasons. And basically what had happened is, you know, they lost a number of their formerly union employees when they moved from a union operation to a freestanding restaurant. And so, you know, they had a whole bunch of new people who they'd never really had to train in that way before. It always was, you know, you hire a new person when somebody comes on, they get the training, but it was one person at a time as opposed to an entire restaurant full of people. So basically, in upholding the role of GM, I was able to get to know the staff and find out, you know, what it is that they did and what was the right way. Because I would ask five people, how do you do XYZ? And they would all have a different, you know, opinion on that. And so what I did was I identified what the service was, and then I created manuals and documents to display that. And then I trained them again on, this is the way we're going to do it, got them on board. And then we hired a new GM, I trained her, and then, you know, really just continued with making change and, you know, structuring the service systems that they had already in place.
Right. So it's consulting for the front of the house. Not
yes.
Anything tied into the back of the house? I mean, it's all tied together, but...
Well, I've actually worked with a number of chefs, and I get brought on by chefs with some regularity now. I tend to work with people because I do a lot of menu training. And to me, knowledge is power, and the most confident waiters are the ones that have the clients that trust them, and they sell the most. And, you know, you want to be confident in the role that you have. So I do a lot of training on service, but I also do a lot of food and beverage training. But the menu training is key. So I will create, you know, training documents around that, from menu descriptions to how to talk about the food to a food glossary, so that any terms or ingredients they're not familiar with, they can learn about. And that's why, you know, I think I've worked with so many chefs now, because they know that I value that just as much as, you know, the steps of service.
Yeah, just listening to you, I'm thinking, I want a restaurant just to hire you.
Awesome.
that's where I'm at. No, it sounds great. And I feel everyone, because I, with doing PR for restaurants, I feel everyone could, you know, need that help and guidance for someone who's experienced and sees it from the outside looking
in. And that's the thing, because I will get, you know, like a Le Cirque, they wrote the book. I was very humbled when they said they needed help. They really did write the book on fine dining. So, you know, when you're called in to help a brand that's already been established and help them do better, I mean, really what my process is to go in and ask questions, find out what's going on, who's, you know, who's doing what, and is that important? Do we need that? Is that happening at the right time? So I do a lot of interviewing, and I do a lot of time talking to even, you know, everybody in service, right, to find out how is it operating and what's happened and what's changed. Try to get a finger on the pulse and then try to save the bits that are there and that they're known for, because that's essential. And then try to just, you know, rejigger or readdress the things that are becoming a little frayed.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, we're going to take a little break, come back, talk some more with Kate Edwards. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by TaxStar, and this one's called Third Degree Rug Burns.
This episode is brought to you by One House. At One House, we noticed that most serious chefs and managers don't hang out in brightly lit offices. So we go out in the field to gather the best talent wherever they may be. We meet and talk to them, like humans used to do back in the day. We are the people people. Our talent sourcing covers salaried dining room, kitchen, and corporate professionals. We thrive in Michelin-starred, James Beard, and mom-and-pop environments alike, from coast to coast. Drop us a line at one-haus.com or at info@one-haus.com. for our confidential, up-to-date, and relevant career options, or if you're an operator seeking a culinary or management-level pro.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Kate Edwards of Kate Edwards Consulting, a top hospitality consulting agency in New York City. And I want to get a little more into the nuts and bolts of what you do. So you work with clients, I see on your website, services. You build, revitalize, and empower. And then you also have these core values, the 7 E's. Right. So let's talk about those. And how did you come up with this, just based on your experience, and you like the letter E.
I like the letter E. Well, it's interesting. So, like, you know, there's some phrase about the cobbler's kids have no shoes, right? One of the hallmarks of what I do is creating mission and core values for my clients, especially for new companies, because I believe in it. And then I was like, I don't have that. And I was hiring an intern. And I was like, I need to have this. So I started, and it was actually kind of cool in a way to do it already being in business, and then, you know, as opposed to saying, this is what I hope to do, this is what I do, or this is what I'm known for, this is what I hope to uphold. And I did it sort of from the educational point of view, like if somebody's going to join my team, if I have an intern, this is what they need to know about how I think about my clients and how I treat them. And I think one of the first ones I came up with was empathy. You know, empathy is something that I do feel for my clients, and I feel for them, especially if they're coming to me because they're in a time of need or they need some assistance. So empathy was really the first one. And energy was another one too, where it was like, you know, I'm going to bring energy to this. I want to put my best energy into this. And so really when I put it together, I put down, as I do for my clients, I put down all the words that make sense to me. And I realized there were a few that stood out and they had something in common, which happened to be they started with E. And then I realized I could actually make a whole list of E's mm-hmm. that sort of, explained and expressed what I or we do as a company for our clients and why that's important.
Yeah, no, I love that. That makes sense. And starting with empathy is, I think, a good place to start.
Yeah.
So I think it's hard for people, just people in general, to get help or to get guidance from someone on something.
Right.
So rebuild or building, revitalizing, empowering, that's the approach.
Yes.
And is it the same for every client, or you kind of look in and figure out what needs work?
Well, generally clients fall into one of the three categories. So build would be if you have a new concept that you want to build, right? So it would be starting from scratch. And one of the aspects of my work is doing concept development. So it'd be really getting in with the client and finding out what it is they want to do. How are we going to express that? How are we going to enunciate that to their guests and to their potential guests? Decide who their guests are and then figure out what location would be best in order to serve those people. So really building the concept from the ground up. Revitalize could be a number of things, but revitalize generally means, you know, like some of these other clients where they have an existing place, they're feeling like it's not going as it should. And so I'm going to go in there and help them revitalize and, you know, hopefully bring it back to where it was or where they'd like it to be. So revitalize means sort of, you know, a revitalization project in general. And then empower is really about you as an entrepreneur, you as a leader, trying to help you empower yourself and empower your team with knowledge and skills. And that comes vis-a-vis my expertise in executive coaching. And I found out that when you say executive coaching to a bunch of restaurant people, half of them will say, oh, right. And half of the other people will be like, what's that?
Right.
So we don't deal with executive coaching, and nobody in the restaurant world considers them an executive. I mean, maybe some people do, but the people that I deal with, mom and pops and entrepreneurs, they don't. So I realized that what I did was really entrepreneurial coaching. And so I work with entrepreneurs on their leadership skills and building them up to be the most powerful and confident leader they can be. And then I also work with their teams, and primarily that's managers, but also a lot of chefs. I do a lot of coaching with chefs because a lot of times chefs get sort of shuttled down sort of an old fashioned training route, which is, you know, do as I say, I'm not as I do, the yes chef mentality, and then even sometimes sort of you know, this militaristic or almost aggressive way of managing, where you're managing by strength, not by you know, inspiration. So it's trying to help them learn new techniques for being effective in their role, and I find that incredibly rewarding. And you know, I've had some people really make some significant change that really makes them feel good about what they're doing.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
What would you say is the biggest challenge of going into restaurants and helping them out?
Well, the first thing with anybody or any business that wants to change, they have to want to change. Because if they don't really want to change, then there's really no sense in me trying to help them change, because it's not going to be the right timing. Generally, people who bring me on are at that point. So it's, you know, lucky for me that they really are ready. I don't feel like there's too much where people are put off by, you know, hearing the criticism per se, or working with somebody. What I find, though, is it's hard for them to sometimes own it. So I'll come in and I'll say, you know, here's a way to do it. And they'll say, oh, can you do it? I'll be like, well, I can do it. But, you know, we got to train your team on how to do it so that you can do this, use this new technique or use this tool. And I'm big on it. You know, if I can do it, if I can use it, that doesn't matter. It matters if you can use it and you can, you want it, you want to take it to the next level. So for instance, I do a lot of documents and manuals and training guides for people, but if you're not going to use it, let's not do it. Right? Let's find another method that's going to work for you. Maybe it's, you know, figuring out a punch list or something like that, or bullet points as opposed to a book. Because some people want the book, and some people are like, we're not going to look at your book. So it's really important for me that whatever I present them has to be something they can use and keep rolling with long after I'm gone.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Who are some of your current clients? If you can say, I don't know.
Yeah, it depends, because some are coaching clients, and that, you know,
if you want to,
I could say recent clients.
Okay, recent clients.
Well, I feel like I'm pretty lucky. I've had a number of clients that have come back to me. Before, I worked with Il Buco in 2008, and then I worked with them again last summer, which is always a really cool thing.
I feel the same way.
Yeah, it's like the highest compliment.
Exactly.
Can pay you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who else? I've worked with. I have a client who owns Rosemary's, Claudette, and Bobo.
Oh, right.
And it's been cool seeing them evolve and grow over the years, and I really am a big fan of them. And who else? Gee whiz. I worked with the Knickerbocker Hotel last year.
Oh, nice.
Which was pretty cool.
I still want to go to the rooftop cloud.
Yeah, I have not. That's beautiful.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's right in the center of everything. Yeah. And it's oddly peaceful up there for being sort of right in Times Square. You know, you just get the sort of white noise sound, and it's really quite lovely up there.
Yeah, I had lunch once there, and it was very nice.
But oh, good.
I think that was pre-opening of the roof. So
right. Yeah, because they opened in the winter, so yeah, the roof didn't open for a few months after even I left. So, yeah, it's beautiful up there.
Yeah.
There's so many great places in New York City.
Oh, yeah, I try to get to them all, and it's impossible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I have a long list.
Yeah, long list. So let me ask you the questions I have from my show last week. I had on Carrie Welsh and Mike Thielen, the co-founders of Feast Portland, which is a premier food and wine festival, and in the Pacific Northwest, and I was there this last weekend. It was fabulous. So they want to know, how are you advising your clients on tipping policies, and are you seeing a change there with minimum wage increases?
Well, it's interesting. So there are people who are asking questions, but mostly people are not changing, in my experience, mm-hmm. the status quo. And I feel like the friends and colleagues I have who are working in, let's say, Oregon or in Washington State, they already are paying much higher hourly wages. And some of them are just used to it. That's just what you pay. And also, I think the climate out there is slightly different because there's a number of restaurants that are doing service included. We've had not the same track record here in New York City. There's some restaurants that have done it, and I think the restaurants that have better luck at it are the higher end restaurants, you know, like the Moderns, the Maialinos, or Per Se. And we changed it when I was there. So that was a great lesson. But I sort of, my personal take is that I think culturally we're going to have to switch as a culture, because I think it's too hard for a lone business to raise their prices in order to do service included on their own, because there's too much competition. When you walk down, let's say, Second Avenue, you know, you've got restaurant after restaurant after restaurant, or in Chelsea, restaurant after restaurant. And for the average consumer walking by and saying, okay, this is what's on the menu and this is the price, if they don't realize offhand that the service is included, it's just going to be their pocketbook talking. And there's been a number of restaurants that have already said, okay, we're going to do service included, and then they switch back of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think for the consumer, it's not quite as important yet. But I do think it's time for prices to go up. I mean, the prices of, you know, a meal in a restaurant, you know, on the low end hasn't changed a heck of a lot, you know, which is great for the consumer, but it's also not realistic because the margin for the operators is so very small to begin with. The prices are just going to have to go up when their costs go up. You know, that is going to have to be passed on to the you know, consumer in some fashion, you know. But you know, and I think also people like being able to talk with their wallet again in terms of the service they're getting and making a comment to the restaurant. So, you know, I know I was in Italy once and there's no tipping there, and I had an experience with fantastic food and horrendous service. And I felt so like mad that there wasn't any way mm-hmm. I could display it except by talking to the manager who did nothing. So it was like, you know, and even though I don't want to, well, it was actually the waiter's fault, but you know, like I'm not somebody who usually does, you know, like take it out on the waiter, but in the one case where I didn't have the opportunity, it felt sort of weird as a client to not be able to have a waiter
right.
to comment on that.
Yeah, I feel the same way. And actually when I was in Portland dining around, everywhere was tipping except I went to Beast, Naomi Palmer's restaurant. And I didn't know it was service included until the bill came. And the service was so great, I felt like I wanted to leave something.
That's right.
But I feel restaurants that are implementing it that know it's included and are, I mean, that was a set menu. And I feel like they're at that level where the service isn't going to be any less. Like, that's the type of restaurant it is where it's like...
Right.
It's just, it's on point.
Right.
And they were so warm and lovely. But yeah, when I saw that, I was like, I was in a sense glad that it was going to be less expensive than I had anticipated. But at the same time, I was expecting to leave a nice gratuity.
That's right.
So it's interesting.
That's what we saw when we did change it at Per Se, was people after having, you know, a flurry of people at your table all night for a number of hours mm-hmm. to not say thank you monetarily was almost off-putting. People were like, no, I can't do that. So, you know, we had to change things around a little bit so that people, if they wanted to leave something additionally, they could, even though they were told, you know, in the reservation, on the menu, and in person, that they weren't right. required or obligated to leave one. But most people did leave something additional, even if it was, you know, $10.
Right.
But I think that it's that thing we like as a consumer to be able to reward or remove, right, with our own discrepancy.
And we're also used to that as the cultural right. changes you were talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So to me, it's got to change. So I hope that's answering their question.
I don't think
people are, you know, people aren't, you know, really jumping off the tipping ship quite yet, because I don't think
right.
it's reached the tipping point, if you will, because I don't think enough people are doing it.
Yeah.
No. Unless you're high end. High end, I think you can get
or
away
unless
with
you're
it.
Danny Meyer.
Yeah,
that
Danny
has
Meyer.
A whole
yeah,
restaurant
exactly.
group. And,
that's
yeah.
right. That's right. But he's only doing it at some restaurants. So he's not doing it all at all.
I thought he was slow by slow implementing it all of them. Except Shake Shack.
Yeah.
I mean those.
Well,
I mean
maybe I'm behind the times then, yeah. Because I know it's at Milano. I know it's at
Yeah,
Modern.
I feel like he's been rolling it out.
Right.
And
okay.
he started with the Modern, but he hasn't gotten through them all
right.
yet.
Okay. Well, yeah. he's going to be the case study then.
Yeah,
he's
going
to be one to watch.
Yeah.
So when it hits MARTA.
More power to him.
You know, and that's in a more
right.
casual environment, you know, what
we'll
will
see.
People be doing? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And their other question was, would you like to go to Feast next year?
Absolutely.
Yes, I recommend it.
Absolutely.
Cool. Okay, we're going to take another break here. We're going to come back. We're going to play my speed round game and then talk some industry news. This is all in the industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Music for this break is brought to you by Shadowbox, and this one's called Let's Not.
We're back. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Kate Edwards. It's time for my speed round game. What this is I name a couple of things and you just pick your preference.
Awesome.
Here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Lately, eat in.
Okay.
My chef's a husband. My husband's a chef. Right?
Lucky you. How about wine, beer, cocktail, or mocktail?
Beer.
Cool. Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
I don't know. I'm just going to say large plates.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's no right
I
or
like
wrong.
Them both.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Chef's counter.
Here it is. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
For now, tipping.
Okay. Consulting on a project pre-opening or post?
Pre.
Teaching or writing? Something else you
Ooh.
Do.
That's a tough one. I guess teaching.
I've been to one of your classes. You're a very good teacher.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
I love it.
How about cheese plate or dessert?
Cheese plate.
And Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Manhattan.
All right. Manhattan. Awesome. That was the game.
Don't tell anyone here.
They haven't kicked anyone out yet that
okay,
says
good.
Manhattan.
Okay, good.
So I think you're okay. Okay, so industry news. First, I just wanted to take a moment to talk about Feast Portland, which, as I said, I was at this last weekend. It's presented by Bon Appetit, and my last show I had on the co-founders, and it was a really incredible food and wine festival. So well executed. Highlights, the Sandwich Invitational, Night Market, smoked, it rained, but it didn't matter. People were out enjoying the food. It was fantastic. And Sunday's Village Brunch, which had the best low-key vibe of any large tasting event I'd ever been at. It was just very chill. And the lineup of chefs was stellar. Everyone from Andy Ricker of Pock Pock to Tony Mays of Craigie on Main. And so many delicious bites from fresh oysters to hearty sandwiches and heavenly croissants. Open Table had this nice lounge at the Sentinel Hotel that was great. And I got to hang out with some industry friends, including Judy Ann Wu, Meryl Evans, and Sal Rizzo. So next year, 6th annual feast is September 14th through 17th. Mark your calendars. Their website's feastportland.com. It's a really great weekend. However, over this great weekend, on Twitter, I opened it up and I saw this awful news, which we're going to talk about now. It was an article in the New York Times about how Dorothy Kane Hamilton, the founder of the French Culinary Institute, passed away in a car accident. She was 67. And again, I saw this on Twitter and I basically froze. I just couldn't believe it because Dorothy is was an incredible woman, a leader in the industry. She also hosted a show on Heritage Radio Network called Chef Story, which I loved. She's a member of La Dame Scoffier, which I'm a member of. And I didn't know her that well, but I knew her and a lot of great respect for her. And I'm still shocked that she's passed away.
I believe it. That's what I've seen, too. I learned about it through a Facebook friend who wrote an RIP, and I was like, what the heck?
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw it in the papers and, you know, online.
Yeah, yeah, I had to double check it because I was like, that can't be true.
Right, right. Yeah, she's Alice Watersian in sort of profile and impact on the industry.
Yeah, she had a tremendous impact, and so many chefs and people we know went to FCI, which then changed to ICC. And yeah, it's just awful, tragic news.
Yes.
So I come away with coming back to, you know, you got to live every day to the fullest and try not to stress out and enjoy life. And she's left her mark. And so I know we will greatly miss her. I will.
That's right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, the mourning that we've been hearing is from people who she made an impact on. And that's the thing. I believe that you have an impact to make. You have a chance to make an impact on someone every single day. And here's somebody who we're hearing wonderful, beautiful stories of making an impact.
Yeah.
So, you know, take that to heart.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was the sad news I had today. And the other article I picked out was in the New York Times, The Magnificent 10, Restaurants That Changed How We Eat, by Tejal Rao. And this is about Paul Friedman, a professor of medieval history at Yale University, has a new book called 10 Restaurants That Changed America. And I thought this was a great topic, actually, for us to discuss. I don't know you saw this list, but it had restaurants, including Delmonico's in New York, Antoine's in New Orleans. And,
yeah.
It's a good list. Some of these restaurants aren't here anymore, but
right.
What did you take of it?
I thought it was pretty fascinating. I liked the reasons why. You know,
mm-hmm.
I liked the one that got me was Schraff's, and for me, I'd always heard of Schraff's as being a place where they discovered starlets in the 40s and 50s sitting at the counter. But I loved that it was also a place that was designed to empower women. To be able to go out alone, because in those days you were not allowed to go to a restaurant by yourself, unaccompanied. What? So they designed a restaurant where women could go because men were out off to war. So it wasn't something that you were a downtrodden woman. You were just taking care of yourself and taking care of your family. And that they also hired so many women and gave women a platform to get in the business. I was like, wow, that is great, great, great. Love that that was on the list. Love learning something new.
Yeah. No, it is a very interesting, good list. Yeah, I liked that Howard Johnson's was on the list,
right,
as a restaurant I was familiar with growing up.
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
And had, you know, I mean, many have closed. I remember when I moved to New York and there was the Howard Johnson's in Times Square.
In Times Square, exactly right.
And that was a sad day when it closed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the end of an era, for
it
sure.
It really was.
Right.
So this I think is probably an interesting book for anyone who wants to see influence of restaurants and,
right,
and their history a bit.
Yeah, very cool article. Very interesting, yeah, how he came to put the list together, too.
Yeah, I agree. And on that note, we're going to take one more break. I'm come back. I'm going to do my solo dining experience. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Music for this music break is brought to you by RecTech, and this track is called Field Trip World.
Back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. It's time for my solo dining experience. So this week, it's at Kachka. Here's the rundown. Location, 720 Southeast Grand Avenue in Portland, Oregon. The concept, a homage to Russian cuisine. The executive chef, Bonnie Morales. Why did I go? Because I heard this place was awesome, and it's received national attention for its Eastern European cuisine. My experience. So I made an early reservation for one, as I had a busy night ahead, with the night market, followed by a second dinner, because that's how I roll. From the moment I walked in, I felt genuinely welcomed, and the staff was very gracious. What did I get? I ordered the Ruski Suzuki Experience, which provides a tasting of an array of cold appetizers, including its signature herring under a fur coat, a beautiful layered salad. My table was covered with five plates with everything from an assortment of pickles to blini and caviar. I also ordered a hot black tea. My take? Bite after bite, I was impressed. Flavor combinations were unique and very flavorful. The ambiance, a familiar atmosphere with brownish diamond-papered wallpaper, montage of old Soviet posters and photos, which gave the feeling of someone's home with the culture that comes with it. I'd say it's perfect for trying a cuisine you may be less familiar with and for vodka lovers, as it offers more than 70 varieties. Interesting tidbit, Kachka has received many accolades, including GQ's 25 Most Outstanding Restaurants in 2015 and Bill Addison's The National 38 on Eater. Plus, it got a nice report in the New York Times. Personal fun fact, I am currently representing a Russian fast casual restaurant in New York City called Taramok. They have over 300 locations in Russia. They opened their first New York City location in June near Madison Square Garden, and they're opening a second outpost in Chelsea this month. The cost of my meal was $28. That's not including tip, but there is no tax, which is a nice thing in Portland. Would I go back? Yes. Their website is kachkapdx.com, and that's K-A-C-H-K-A-P-D-X. So that was cool. Russian dinner.
And I support two dinners. I think that's fantastic.
Thank you. I'm still posting photos on my Instagram from meals I had because it was too much to post all in real time. So people following my Instagram think I'm still in Portland, exactly. Even though I'm really here in Bushwick.
Right.
So yeah, it was great. Portland has a really, really strong dining scene. Impressive.
Legendary.
Yeah. So... okay, it's time for the final question. My next guest is Maureen Cushing. She's the Vice President of IT and Processes at Union Square Hospitality Group, and she's the co-founder of Tech Table Summit, which is taking place next Wednesday, the 28th of September. So, Kate, can you ask a question for Maureen?
Absolutely. First of all, I have 1,000 questions for Maureen. It's fascinating, and the Tech Table sounds really cool, and it's sold out, so... go you. I love that. Okay, so the one question I have is actually sort of more for my clients, but I still would love to know the answer. So what do you sort of recommend? Like, what would be your top three tips for new restaurateurs for them to connect their hospitality brand experience to the various technological things they use? So what are ways that restaurateurs can connect hospitality actively to tech?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm curious about that too, even as a publicist to know, right. You know, ways that you could do that.
Right. That's a feature even that I read about in my book, because I feel like the customer service experience starts online. So I would love to know what she does and love to know how she puts it together.
Yeah. And I have to check out your book, which is awesome. You wrote a book.
Thank you. Yeah, please do. Yeah. I did like writing, I have to say.
Yeah.
I was surprised how much I did enjoy the process.
When did the book come out?
Way at the beginning of this year.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's good to know. I think writing a book is different than writing an article or, know, like it's...
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
It's good you enjoyed
it. Yeah, it's great.
Well, great. That is the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming out. I'm impressed with everything you do. I think it's... I think you're such a value for restaurants and all your experience that you can share it with others and help them succeed. So
thank you very much. I do appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. So my guest today has been Kate Edwards of Kate Edwards Consulting. You can find her at kateedwardsconsulting.com. She's on Twitter at @ServiceDefined and Instagram @KateEdwardsNYC. You can find me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are BayerPublicRelations.com and SherryBayer.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes and Stitcher, so you can listen to us anywhere, anytime. Many thanks to my show's fall season sponsor. It's One House. Their website is one-house.com, Twitter one_house, and Instagram onehouse, and that's O-N-E-H-A-U-S. So next week, I am going to this Tech Table Summit, so I'm not going to be here. So my next live show is Wednesday, October 5th. That's with Maureen Cushing. Thanks always to my fabulous engineer, Pierre. I'm Sherry Bayer. Thank you for being part of All in the Industry. See you in 2 weeks. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Everybody gets broke.